And how are we going to take this entire big world, this entire land, and this vast amount of property that exists in the world, and decide which people are going to get that land? Should we distribute it equally? That would take care of everyone. Should we say no? Everyone, the strongest, have the right to get as much as they can, even if it's going to come at the expense of someone else. How are we going to decide who is it that gets which land? And traditionally, classically, throughout the course of history, two systems have developed in trying to answer this question. And they're what we call capitalism and socialism. And every country, every civilization over the course of history pretty much has opted for one or the other, either a capitalist approach or a socialist approach, just to delineate some of the differences between capitalism and socialism and define what we're talking about. Capitalism is the system which advocates private ownership. In a capitalist society, in a capitalist state, individuals have the right to private ownership, to what we call free enterprise, to self-sufficiency. I'm allowed to own my own field. I'm allowed to work that field, and I'm allowed to gain profit from my field. It doesn't necessarily have to be a field if we don't live in an agricultural society. Let's say a business. I'm allowed to start my own business, buy my own building, own the business, earn my own profit, and figure out how I want to earn my income. And one of the features of capitalism is that it runs on the profit motive. What motivates me to work and what motivates me to produce is profit. The harder I work, the more I'm going to gain. The more profit I'm going to make, the more money I'm going to have. On the flip side, the opposite of capitalism is socialism. And other societies, other civilizations over the course of the history of mankind have opted to implement socialism instead of capitalism. And socialism looks to deal with one of the problems that is afforded by capitalism, and that is, in a capitalist state, in a capitalist society, where there is this right to private ownership, there's this right to free enterprise, so we run a risk. And what's the obvious risk of any capitalist society, any capitalist state? That there are going to be people who fall through the cracks. Right, economic equality. In a capitalist society where there's a right to free enterprise, so Reuven might make it big. Reuven might be very successful. Shimon might not be as intelligent of a businessman. He might not be as strong physically. For whatever reason, Shimon might not make ends meet, and he might be left with nothing. And that problem, socialism looks to solve. And socialism says, since we want to get rid of that economic equality, we want to eradicate the problem of poverty. So in a socialist state, the state owns property. And the state hands out income to the members, to the citizens of that society equally. And a socialist state runs on the principle of equality, and it makes sure that everyone is taken care of. But in addition to capitalism and socialism, in order to really fully understand the question that we're talking about and answer the question of who owns property, we need to introduce one other term, and that is communism. Communism is a term many of us are familiar with and we've heard of. Defining the difference between socialism and communism, however, is a little tricky. Capitalism, we understand. Capitalism, let's put aside for a second. That's the private ownership, self-sufficiency, free enterprise. Put it on the side for now. We'll come back to it later. What's the difference between socialism and communism? And the truth of the matter is, I'll tell you from the outset that this is a matter of some debate. Not everyone agrees what the exact distinction between socialism and communism is. But here are some of the featured highlights, the generally accepted principles which are listed in order to differentiate one from the other. We said before that a feature of a socialist state, the defining aspect of socialism, is that there's no private ownership. Everything is owned collectively by the state. That's not entirely true. That's almost true, but it's not entirely true. Because a socialist state does allow for some private ownership. Socialism will have the main means of wealth be communal. The things that everybody in society needs, main staples of life, take for an example electricity. So an electric company in a socialist state will be owned by the state. It won't be run by private individuals because that's a staple of life that everybody needs. But that doesn't mean, in most socialist states, that doesn't mean that I can't have my own field on the side, you know, grow my tomatoes and market my tomato business. Doesn't mean I can't have my own, let's say, even my own medical practice, my own law practice. I could have a job on the side, something that's not necessarily an essential staple that everyone in society needs. In many socialist states, although the main means of wealth are communal, there are still small businesses that are allowed to remain private. Communism, however, is an extreme. Communism essentially, and this is the first critical difference between socialism and communism, communism takes the socialist way of thinking to the extreme. And in a communist state, there is no private ownership. Everything is owned by the state, and all property is communal, main means of wealth, and the small businesses alike. But there's one other difference between socialism and communism, and this is a very important distinction for us going forward, and that's the question of motive. What is motivating any given society to be socialist or to be communist? Why does the state decide to adopt a socialist stance or a communist stance? So socialism is more often than not motivated by idealism. There are certain ideals that a socialist state strives to live by, and whether they're implemented practically, whether they actually work out, it's ideal-based, and very often a socialist state runs by the desire to create almost a type of utopian society. There's a value, there should be no poverty in the world. And whether that's an attainable goal, whether that's reasonable and practical, it's a goal, it's a value, it's an ideal that we should eradicate poverty. Socialism might be motivated by such an ideal. All men are created equal. That's a value, that's an ideal. A socialist state might try to accomplish that ideal. Communism is very different. Communism does not run based on ideals or values. Communism is very often, nowadays, associated with the philosophy of Karl Marx. Who was Karl Marx? So Karl Marx had a very radical view of the way history works. And the view of Marx, I'll tell you the term and then I'll explain it. According to Marx, history is a series of class struggles between the bourgeoisie and the proletariat. What does that mean? Marx said that the way history is going to work is inevitable. There's going to be a cyclical nature in which history takes, in which certain cycles are going to repeat themselves over and over again, always ending, in his view, communism. And he explains as follows. He says, let's go back to the beginning of the world. Hashem created the world, created the land, and then he created man. And mankind goes and starts to take ownership of the land. And on their own, they intuitively form some type of capitalist system because each man for himself just goes and takes land. They decide there will be a private ownership. There will be free enterprise. And over time, what's going to happen is some are going to succeed and some are going to fail. The strongest, the smartest, the most clever, the most savvy, they're going to make the most money. They're going to become the most wealthy. And then inevitably, there are going to be those who fall through the cracks and become poor. And that's what Marx called the bourgeoisie and the proletariat. The bourgeoisie are those who rise to the top, those who become very wealthy, while the proletariat are the middle and lower class, who don't make it as far as the bourgeoisie, who aren't as financially taken care of. And Marx said, so what's going to happen when this occurs? When the bourgeoisie rise to the top and the proletariat starts to sink to the bottom, so what's going to happen? The proletariat starts going to start getting frustrated, and they're going to start getting jealous. And those feelings of frustration and jealousy over time, they're going to simmer. And then after a while, they're going to lead to action. And the proletariat is going to try to take action against the bourgeoisie to overthrow the current order in the world and to try to create a new order in which they can be on top and in which they can be earning as much as the bourgeoisie. And this is going to be the overthrow of the social order that the proletariat is going to cause. And when this happens, who's going to win? So says Marx, well, the bourgeoisie is a very small, that's the small elite, a small minority of people who actually made it, the proletariat, those who didn't become as wealthy, that's going to be the majority of people. That's going to be the majority of society. So they're going to win. The proletariat is going to win just by sheer numbers. They're going to overthrow the bourgeoisie. Now when that happens, when they win, so now they're going to be in the driver's seat. And they're going to get to decide, so how should we set up society again? Now with this new economy that we're now going to control, so how are we going to try to, what system are we going to put into place? So are they going to want to go back to capitalism? Are they going to want to have free enterprise and the right to self-sufficiency, private ownership again? Obviously not, because they were the victims of it last time. They know it doesn't work out. And so they are going to opt for communism. Everything's going to be owned by the state, equality, everyone will be taken care of, we'll eradicate poverty. According to Marx, that's the driving force of communism. Communism is the inevitable outcome of the series of class struggles that history will need to take, that man's unbridled desire for material wealth will prompt him to always lead the world towards a state of communism. And the reason this is important to understand that we're emphasizing it is because when we go to the next question, which is our topic for today, of what's the Torah's approach, does the Torah choose capitalism or socialism? So one thing that's not on this list is communism. Because the Torah certainly doesn't choose communism. Capitalism and socialism are value-driven. And we can debate which are the appropriate values. And in the coming discussion, we will have a chance to see what are the values of capitalism, what are the values of socialism. But communism, the idea that all of history and all of mankind is driven by this insatiable urge and this insatiable need for material gain and material wealth, that certainly is not the hashkafa of the Torah. So for our purposes going forward, we are going to explore the question, does the Torah choose capitalism or socialism? And there is perhaps no greater mitzvah, there are others, but there's no greater mitzvah that can serve as a paradigm for exploring this question than the mitzvah of Shemitah. We usually think of the mitzvah of Shemitah as a year. Shemitah is the seventh year, and that's all it is. But for this presentation, I want us to think of Shemitah differently, not as a year, but as a cycle. Shemitah is a seven-year cycle that recurs over and over again. There are 6 years of working the land. The Torah tells us when it introduces the mitzvah of Shemitah. V'sheish shanim tizra'as artzecha v'asafta es tevuasaf. For 6 years, you should work, sow your land, artzecha, your land, v'asafta es tevuasaf, and you gather in its produce. For 6 years, you own land. There's private ownership. There's free enterprise. You're allowed to work. You're allowed to sow your land. You're allowed to gather in its produce. What we might call the Torah's 6 years of capitalism. But that's followed by the Hashiviyis Tishmetena Untashta. Perhaps the most defining feature of the Shemitah year. In the seventh year, every landowner needs to relinquish ownership of his land. No one is allowed to privately own land during the Shemitah year. And the Pasuk continues, the poor people must be allowed to enter the land and eat. The animals must be able to enter the field and eat. It must be open game. Everyone can come into the field and eat from this field. I'm not allowed to privately own it and keep any other people out. And we might view this as 1 year of socialism, 1 year in which private ownership is not allowed. Everyone relinquishes their rights to this field. So when we look at Shemitah, not as a year, but as a cycle, as a seven-year cycle that recurs over and over again, so we get an interesting thing. And the question of, does the Torah choose capitalism or socialism? So it seems we have first 6 years of capitalism, followed every time by 1 year of socialism. And to define our terms further, you know, we said that in the Shemitah year, every person relinquishes his rights to private ownership, his rights to his own land. So what does that mean? When I own a field, and I relinquish my rights to that land, so the halakhic term for what happens is I'm mafkir my land. The institution of hefker, which we're familiar with, which we learn in various contexts, the idea of hefker is actually derived from Shemitah. Shemitah, the hefker of the fields during the Shemitah year, is the source for all of hefker in the entire Torah. We usually translate hefker as ownerless. When I declare something hefker, that means I am making it ownerless. But Rav Shimon Shkup challenges that definition. Rav Shimon Shkup, the famous Rosh Yeshiva from the early 1900s, the European Rosh Yeshiva, who also taught in this yeshiva for 1 year. So he writes in his famous halakhic work, Shara Yosher, that the true definition of hefker, and as it's derived from Shemitah, is actually not ownerless at all. It means it's owned by everyone. When I declare my field hefker in Shemitah, I'm not saying it's ownerless. I'm saying it's collectively owned by all of us. That's what it means to be mafkir something during Shemitah. That's what Rav Shimon Shkup writes in the Shara Yosher. And if that's the case, that is the most defining feature of socialism. If we needed any paradigm of socialism more than this, 1 year of collective ownership, all the fields of Klal Yisrael are owned collectively, that's what happens during the Shemitah year. And, good. So, the question that we need to ask ourselves is now that we have this setup, the 6 years of capitalism followed by 1 year of socialism, so the question is why? Why does the Torah opt for these 6 years of capitalism? What's the value behind capitalism that has the Torah implement capitalism as its system 6/7 of the time. So Rav Moshe Avigdor Amiel, who was Rav Moshe Avigdor Amiel, Brishus Rebbe. Rav Amiel was a Rav in the early 1900s. He was the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv in the 1930s. Fascinatingly, he actually was chosen over Rav Soloveitchik for that post. And Rav Amiel, in his Sefer Drashos El Ami, deals with this question in explicit terms. He says, does the Torah choose socialism or capitalism? What is the system that the Torah would advocate? And in answering this question, he points to a fascinating story found in the Gemara, Maseches Yuma. The Gemara tells a story about, which occurred in the times of the second Beis HaMikdash, at which time the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, the men of the Great Assembly, they determined that the time had come to eradicate the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah. The evil inclination which urges man to serve idols, that Yetzer Hara had been around for so long, and it had caused so many negative consequences, caused so many people to commit averos. It was time to eradicate this Yetzer Hara. And as strange as it sounds, because how do you eradicate a Yetzer Hara? Yetzer Hara is not something you could go to war with. It's not something you could physically kill. But the Gemara describes how it's possible by whatever means the Anshei Knesset HaGedola took, and they were successful. They eradicated the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah. And then the Gemara says, well, the Anshei Knesset HaGedola said, 1 second. If we were successful in getting rid of the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah, so why stop there? Let's go 1 step further. And they said, why don't we also try to get rid of the Yetzer Hara for Gilay Arayos, for immorality, the Yetzer Hara for illicit relationships? Why don't we try to eradicate that one as well? And they did. The Gemara says, also, they decided, they found this Yetzer Hara, and they eradicated it. The Anshei Knesset HaGedola were successful. But then the Gemara says something remarkable. After this success, they looked around the land of Israel for 3 days and they could not find a single fresh egg. And the reason they realized was because when you eradicate the Yetzer Hara for Gilay Arayos, that urge which prompts man to do terrible things, but by eradicating that urge, that desire, so you're also eradicating the urge for reproduction. Because one depends on the other. And if you eradicate the urge of reproduction, the world can't exist. And Chazal realized, the Anshei Knesset HaGedola realized, this cannot continue. Because if this would continue, the world would cease to be. And they restored the Yetzer Hara for Gilay Arayos. Rav Amiel derives from this Gemara an important principle, and that is that there are certain necessary evils in the world. Things which inherently are not positive, but they're necessary in order for the world to continue to spin, in order for life to continue. And one of them, Rav Amiel points out, is like Chazal realized with the Yetzer Hara for Gilay Arayos, a necessary evil which must exist in order for us to have appropriate channels, in order for the world to continue to exist. A similar Yetzer Hara is the Yetzer Hara for competition. There is a Yetzer Hara that man has to compete with another person, to outdo someone else, to do better than the next person. And that at its core, inherently, that's not a good thing. That's not a value, to want to outdo someone else and to want to do better. But says Rav Amiel, could we imagine a world in which there was no competition? Could we imagine a world in which man was not driven by any motive to compete to do better than someone else? He says production would cease to be. And production certainly at a quality level would cease to be, because what motivates man to produce at a high level, to invent on a high level, to produce things that could contribute to the benefit of all of mankind, is that necessary evil, that need to compete and to outdo someone else. And it has been pointed out that this is one of the shortcomings of systems of socialized medicine. Now, there are debates in the world, what is the best form of healthcare? What's the best form of a medical system in a way that everyone can be taken care of and everyone can be treated? And socialized medicine is a system which provides certain benefits and takes care of people in a way that has many positives, but one of the shortcomings of socialized medicine is we get rid of that competition motive. If a person is looking for optimal care, if a person is sick and they're looking for a doctor who's going to treat him at the highest level, so would I want to go to a doctor who is motivated to perform at the highest level? Or would I want to go to a doctor who, no matter what quality of care he gives me, he's going to earn the same salary? No matter what he does, as long as he reaches a baseline level, he's going to be paid the same amounts. And one of the critiques of systems of socialized medicine is if a doctor doesn't have the right to earn profit independently. He doesn't have the right to, by establishing himself as better than another doctor, to receive a higher level of profit. So that's going to lead to this system providing suboptimal care. And this, in the view of Rav Amiel, is what we could call value number one of the capitalist system. The reason that for 6 years the Torah might advocate capitalism, because private ownership and the motivation of competition, the need to compete, is a value that's needed in order for the world to continue. But it's not the only value of capitalism. There are others as well. Another value of the capitalist system is that it allows us to develop into certain types of people, and it allows us to become giving people. What does that mean? Why would the capitalist system allow us to become giving people? So let's take, for example, a mitzvah with which we're all familiar and we all perform on a pretty frequent basis, and that mitzvah can inform a lot of what we're trying to convey over here. It's the mitzvah of tzedakah, the mitzvah to give charity. And if I would pose the question to this room, if I would ask you, what is the purpose of the mitzvah of tzedakah? So many of you would respond, perhaps all of you would respond, that the purpose of the mitzvah of tzedakah, the purpose of giving charity, is to support the poor people. That's what it means. That's what the definition of the word means. To support poor people, to do good, that's of course the purpose of the mitzvah of tzedakah. But that definition needs to become a little more nuanced when we encounter gray areas. What would we say about the following question? Let's say a person has $1,000 to give to tzedakah, and he has a choice what to do with those $1,000. He can either take all $1,000 and give them to one poor person. And by giving $1,000 to one poor person, that's a pretty significant sum for one person. There's much that a person could do with $1,000. It could be taken care of with that donation. Or the other option, instead of giving $1,000 to one poor person, let him take $1 and give $1 to 1,000 poor people. And which one's better? Which is the better form of tzedakah? Or does it matter? Are they the same? Does it matter which one should the person choose? The Rambam talks about this question. The Rambam in his Perush HaMishnayos and Pirkei Avos writes that when put in such a situation, it is better to give $1 to 1,000 poor people than to give $1,000 to one poor person. And the reason, says the Rambam, is because ultimately the purpose of the mitzvah of tzedakah, yes, is to support poor people, of course. But also, ultimately, in the view of the Rambam, the purpose of giving, as great as it is, doesn't condition the character to becoming a giving person. What would happen if we lived in a socialist world and there was no right to private ownership? Could we become giving people? Can there be a generous person who doesn't own anything? Because if you don't own, how can you give? And if you don't give, how can you become a generous person? And that's another value of the capitalist system. That the Torah wants us to become giving people, the Torah wants us to become generous givers. In order to give, we need to have. We need to own. And it's been pointed out that this is a question, a halachic question, related to kibbutzim in the land of Israel. Kibbutzim, most kibbutzim, are socialist entities. They're places in which the land is collectively owned, and there's no private ownership on kibbutzim. And there's a fascinating sefer called HaKibbutz BaHalacha, which collects various halachic essays from contemporary rabbanim about kibbutzim and the unique shailas that come up on a kibbutz that don't come up anywhere else in the world. And in that sefer, Rav Shlomo Aviner has a fascinating article in which he deals with the question of how does one fulfill the mitzvah of tzedakah on a kibbutz? If I don't own anything and I don't have anything to give, how can I be in fulfillment of the mitzvah of tzedakah? And Rav Aviner at length addresses the question from a halachic standpoint, and he answers technically what's the halachic answer to how I fulfill the mitzvah of tzedakah. But then he also deals with the hashkafa of the issue, and he says, okay, so I've technically fulfilled my obligation. If I live on a kibbutz, am I going to become a giving person? And am I going to cultivate a generous character if I can never really give, if I never really have what to give? And he deals with that question and grapples with it. And it's not an easy question to answer. But the capitalist system allows for that generous character to be cultivated much easier than the socialist system does. Just briefly, three other values of capitalism. The two that we've discussed till now are the two that are found in the literature about this topic, in the Jewish literature about the values of capitalism versus socialism. These two are at the forefront of the values that are discussed. Just three more that I would add on my own. We could answer that there is a value found in formulated by the Rambam in the end of his Hilchos Zechiyo Umatana, the section in the Rambam which talks about acquisition and ownership. The Rambam formulates a value that tzaddikim, ba'anshei ma'aseh, men of great worth, great stature in Judaism, rely on Hashem and not on other people. The Torah tells us, sonei matanos yechiyah. A person shouldn't want to live in a state of dependence on other people, only in a state of dependence on Hashem. In a socialist state, by definition, I'm living in a state of dependence on other people. I'm relying on the state for my paycheck every month. Capitalism affords this value much more. A person can go to work, daven to Hashem, and daven that Hashem will cause his work to come to fruition. He won't need to rely on any other people. Answer number four, there's a sense of earning a person's parnassa. There's a sense of pride and self-worth when a person goes to work, earns his parnassa, and what he earns correlates with the amount of effort he puts in. The Balei Musar talk about a term called nahama de kisufa, bread of embarrassment, which means in a nutshell that the Ramchal discusses this idea at length, that Hashem put us in this world in Olam Hazeh before putting us in the next world, Olam Haba, even though that's the ultimate good and the ultimate place for us. Because had Hashem just created Olam Haba and put us directly there and given us a life of bliss, a life of eternal pleasure in Olam Haba, we would have been embarrassed. We would have felt we're getting all this good and we never earned it, we never deserved it. So we need to live in Olam Hazeh with all its imperfections and with all its failures in order to put in the work to earn our share in Olam Haba. In a socialist state, no one earns anything. In a socialist state, yeah, we all work, but we work for the state, and then the state gives out, the state hands out profit and salary to each person equally. In a capitalist state, a person has the right to earn what he eats, to earn his parnassa, and that value of self-worth and pride is a very core Jewish value as well. And answer number five, our fifth and final answer, is the sense of personal imprint. Not everybody in the world is the same, and not everyone wants to conduct their life in the same way. And people want to express their personality and to express their unique touch in their work in a way that's different than another person. A capitalist system allows for that, while a socialist system does not. In a socialist system, everyone's paycheck looks the same. Everyone's parnassa looks the same. In a capitalist system, I get to put a little bit of myself, my tzelem Elokim, which is different than yours, which is different than the next person's, because everyone was created differently. I could put that into my work, and that's allowed by a capitalist system. So if that's the case, if capitalism is so valuable, to sum up what we've seen till now, we have this 7-year cycle, 6 years of capitalism followed by 1 year of socialism, and we formulated 5 different values of capitalism and why the Torah opts for this approach 6/7 of the time, so what's the story with that 7th year? Why does Shemitah come in? Why do we have 1 year of socialism at all if capitalism is really so valuable? The answer to this question is that as valuable as capitalism is, it breeds certain things within us that we want to avoid. And we need 1 year of socialism to balance out the negatives that are caused by the 6 years of capitalism in order to stabilize our personality in the way that the Torah wants it to be expressed. The Sefer HaChinuch writes that one of the reasons for the mitzvah of Shemitah is to remind us that Hashem is in charge, to instill in us a sense of bitachon. For 6 years, man works. For 6 years, there's private ownership, and there's free enterprise, and there's a right to self-sufficiency. But that can breed a sense of kochi va'otzem yadi, asal li asachayel hazeh. That can breed a sense of man can think that I'm the one who's the source of my income, I'm the one who's really the reason for what I have, and man can forget that really, ultimately, everything comes from Hashem. Says the Sefer HaChinuch, that's one of the reasons for the mitzvah of Shemitah. To remind ourselves, there's 1 year in which we can't work. There's 1 year in which we need to be dependent on Hashem, and that frames our other 6 years as well to remind us always that Hashem is the one who's in charge. Answer number two, also formulated by the Sefer HaChinuch, but discussed even more elaborately and extensively by Rav Kook in the Hakdama and the introduction to his Sefer on Shemitah called Shabbat Haaretz. And they both talk about spirituality. When we live for 6 years in a capitalist system, and we're engaged in a business mindset, and we're engaged in the physical world, and we're exercising competition. So all those are good, and all those things are necessary for all the reasons that we explained. But in the end of the day, it decreases from our spiritual persona. Constant involvement with the physical, constant thinking in terms like competition, things that inherently are not so good, that decreases us spiritually. Rav Kook writes that at the core of every Jewish person are spiritual qualities. What are examples of spiritual qualities? Care, compassion, concern, collaboration, giving. Those are spiritual qualities. Competition, putting down someone else, outdoing another person, constantly engaged in business. Those are physical qualities which are antithetical to spiritual qualities. Now, it's necessary that we engage in the physical. Otherwise, the world couldn't exist. Otherwise, we couldn't earn a parnasa. But for 1 year, we need to tend to our spiritual qualities. We can't forget about the core of who we are and allow the spirituality within us to grow. And finally, number three, we can suggest a third reason for the mitzvah of Shemitah, a third reason for the 1 year of socialism on the heels of 6 years of capitalism, is that we need to remind ourselves of the proper mentality with which we earn money. The proper mentality with which we engage in free enterprise and we engage in earning a living. The Mishnah in Pirkei Avos describes four different personalities, four different ways a person can relate to material wealth and can relate to earning a livelihood. And the one which the Mishnah opts for is Sheli Shalach, the Shalach Shalach. What's mine is yours, and what's yours is yours. That's who the Mishnah calls a chassid, a pious person. And what the Mishnah is conveying is that the mentality with which we approach physical wealth, the mentality with which we approach all the wealth that we earn is Sheli Shalach v'shalach shalach. I earn an income, I earn a livelihood, but what's the mentality? Why am I earning a livelihood? Am I doing it to take care of myself and forget about everyone else? Am I doing it so I can build a bigger house and I can amass more wealth and I can take a greater vacation and forget about everyone else? Or am I doing it, am I having a Sheli so there could be a Shalach? Am I doing it to position myself to be in a better place to be able to contribute to the betterment of society and mankind at large? And that's what Shemitah reminds us. Shemitah reminds us those 6 years of capitalism, and those 6 years of free enterprise of a person earning a livelihood in order to amass wealth is done with the mentality of Sheli Shalach. The reason that I'm doing it is in order to be able to provide for others and to make the world a better place. And so if we had to sum up, in conclusion, in a nutshell, everything that we have discussed, what is the Torah's approach to the question of capitalism versus socialism? It could be summed up in one pasuk. Six words. There are six words that appear in Parshas Kisisa. In the parasha which describes the mitzvah of machatzis ha-shekel, the mitzvah that every Jew must give a half a shekel to the Beis HaMikdash every year. And the Torah tells us, he'oshir lo yarbeh, when it comes to this mitzvah, the rich man may not give more. The rich man can't give more than half a shekel. Ve'hadal, and the poor man, lo yamit, he can't give less than half a shekel. Everyone gives the same, everyone gives a machatzis ha-shekel. But Rav Amiel, who we quoted earlier, Rav Amiel exercises poetic license in interpreting this pasuk, and he interprets it homiletically to say something a little bit differently. And this captures the entire Torah's approach to the question of socialism and capitalism. Says Rav Amiel, He'oshir. One second. He'oshir? He'oshir means a rich man. Are there rich men in the world? In a socialist state, there are no rich men. There's no class system in a socialist state. So he'ashir, Bishus Rebbe. He'ashir. In Yahadus, there is a rich man and there is a class system. But lo yarbeh. The rich man may not become too rich. He may not amass wealth just for the purpose of himself and leave everyone else uncared for. He'ashir, yes, there is a rich man. There is a class system in Yahadus, but lo yarbeh. He can't become too rich. Vehadal, says Rav Amiel, vehadal. There's a poor man in Yahadus. So you see that Yahadus, the Torah can't advocate a socialist system. There clearly is a class system. We clearly recognize the ashir, and we recognize the dal. There is rich, and there is poor. But lo yamit. But the dal may not become too poor. Rav Amiel homiletically explains, the Dal may not be left on his own in a way that the Ashirim don't care for him. And this is what the Torah is trying to convey with the mitzvah of Shemitah. the mitzvah of 6 years of capitalism followed by 1 year of socialism. Yes, we must have ashirim and dalim. Yes, there must be a class system for all of the reasons that we discussed. But ha'ashir lo yarbev, ha'dal lo yamit. In the end of the day, we must make sure that every person is taken care of. And so to sum up what we have seen today, to conclude, what are the values of capitalism? 6/7 of the time, the Torah advocates capitalism, self-sufficiency, the right to private ownership. So number one, the value of competition, that necessary evil that Rav Amiel pointed out, based on the Gemara about destroying the Yetzer Hara. The world can't go on if there's no competitive motive. Becoming givers. In order to give, we need to have. If we don't have, we can't cultivate that generous character that the Rambam talked about. We need to be able to own. Relying on Hashem, not others, the philosophy of Sone Matanos Yechia. We don't want to be in a position where we're dependent on other people. We want to only depend on Hashem. I earned it. The sense of pride, that sense of I earned what I have. It's not Nahama de Kisufa. It's not something that I'm going to be embarrassed and ashamed to receive because what I'm earning doesn't correlate with the work that I put in. But what I'm earning expresses the work that I put in. And finally, the personal imprint. That sense that not everybody is the same and not everyone will express themselves the same way. And each person will be given the right in a capitalist system to put a personal stamp on his work. But we still need that seventh year. That seventh year of socialism to balance out and keep in check all of those negative traits that capitalism breeds, remembering that Hashem is in charge, not kochi ve'otzem yadi asali esachayel hazeh, but maintaining that sense of bitachon and remembering who ultimately is the source for our parnasa. Recharging ourselves spiritually, what Rav Kook spoke about, those spiritual qualities at the core of every Jewish person, not things like competition, putting down another person, but care, compassion, concern, collaboration, things of that nature which we can't tend to in as focused of a way when we're engaged in a business mindset, when we're engaged constantly in growing physically. We need 1 year to recharge ourselves spiritually. And finally, Shali Shalach, remembering what the purpose of amassing wealth is. Yes, the Torah allows us and encourages us to amass wealth. Yes, the Torah encourages private ownership, but Shali Shalach, not for the purpose of building myself up at the expense of other people, but for the purpose of being a person who can be in a position to contribute to the world and make the world a better place. And so in just one sentence, we already saw a pasuk which captures everything that we are saying today. But to conclude with just one phrase, that in a nutshell, what is the Torah's approach, capitalism or socialism? What we're suggesting is that it's capitalism with a sprinkle of socialism. At its core, the Torah advocates capitalism, as formulated by all the values that we saw earlier. But a sprinkle of socialism reminds us of all to keep in check all of the negative qualities produced by a capitalist system. It reminds us, yes, there is a right to free enterprise. Yes, there is a right to amassing wealth. But with the proper perspective that is necessary, with the proper perspective of tending to spirituality, to relying on Hashem always, and to be doing it to be in a position to provide for others and to make the world a better place. Thank you, everyone, for coming. Thank you for listening about this very interesting topic, capitalism and socialism.